Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining us today for SMIE Consulting's Midweek Roundup. Today we'll be covering three important topics in international education, and as we do each week, and whether you're watching this live on Facebook or connecting with our playlist on YouTube or through our podcast, now available on all major providers from iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, Podbean, and Stitcher. You can catch this weekly roundup of midweek roundup of all these important issues each week. Subscribe on those providers, on podcasts, or on YouTube, or on our Facebook page to catch all the latest and our take at SMIE Consulting on how these issues can impact what we do in our field. So we're happy to be with you here today, and we have some interesting topics today. I've just returned from the NAFSA Region 6 conference in Columbus, Ohio, and it was a very productive conference. Good to reconnect with some colleagues I hadn't seen in a while, and to make some new acquaintances with some colleagues who hopefully will be able to work together in the months to come. So a great opportunity, I think, today to talk to you directly about some of these important issues in international education that have popped onto the radar in the last week or so in different news stories, and how those might be impacting what we do at U.S. institutions in terms of international recruitment strategies. So I hope you'll be sit back and engage with us today on the Facebook page, and look forward to your comments and how we might be able to use what we learned today to improve what we do as institutions. So thanks again for joining. Today's topics, the three important ones, a couple of them are fairly related. First is for anyone who's been in international student enrollment, recruitment, admissions, student services, certainly appreciates this, that certain students from certain countries are much more intensely concerned with opportunities for work after they're done with their study, even during their studies, and even before they even apply to your institutions, they are very much concerned with what is possible for them as part of their student experience in the United States. And for those who aren't aware, Indian students represent not only the number two international student demographic in the United States, but also represent a growing population of students who are taking advantage of OPT, the optional practical training time that students have available to them after graduation. And increasingly, a majority of the Indian students coming to the United States are also looking at STEM OPT, which provides an additional 2 years of work experience in their field of study beyond the initial one that all F1 international students have available after they finish each degree level. So as per always, I post the links to these news stories on our Facebook page in the event for this video live chat. So the first one is from the Times of India, which correctly has the data laid out for the percentage of Indian students that are engaging in STEM OPT. And right now, at present, Indian students held 56% of the total STEM OPT authorizations in 2017, fiscal year 2017. Chinese students, even though they represent the largest single group, with over 300,000 students studying in the United States, they represent only 24% of the total STEM OPT authorizations. Now, that has a lot of different reasons for that, but certainly one of those may be economic in terms of the opportunities for jobs after graduation for Chinese students back home may be better than perhaps what's available to Indian students, or Indian students have perhaps a different longer-term objective beyond just the study degree and the work experience, not necessarily maybe going back to India. There are a lot of different models out there that and opinions on this, but certainly this data certainly reflects not only the concern, not the concern, the expectation that Indian students have that they have this work opportunity available to them, and that particularly with STEM OPT, having that additional 2 years, it becomes a much more attractive work experience destination in the United States. So they are have been certainly the numbers have been increasing in terms of, and have probably have peaked in the last year or two in terms of the numbers from India, from China, and others that are pursuing OPT, STEM OPT in particular. So right now, 50,000 of the fiscal year 17, 50,507 Indian students were approved for STEM OPT in this past fiscal year, and less than half that amount were from China, 21,705. So definitely some interesting numbers, and for anyone who's recruited in India, meeting students, meeting parents, the topic of post-study work is always near or at the top of the list of folks of their concerns and what they're eager to find out more about. So for universities that are new to recruiting in India, whether undergrad or graduate, certainly being aware of this as a need for that market is certainly a very good weapon to have in your arsenal in terms of how you can respond to the questions that you get from parents, from students about post-study work. You'll obviously know what your own institutional procedures are, and if you don't, as a recruiter, you certainly want to become familiar with that. If your office does not also handle student advising or work with the Career Center in terms of any OPT or practical training issues that international students have or benefits that they have, and process how that works on your campus, certainly good to familiarize yourself with what that can mean or will mean for your future Indian students coming to your campus, so that you can better articulate to them what your plans are, what the possibilities are for them if they choose to come to your institution. One other piece on this front, on the work front, that is related to it is oftentimes OPT is a bridge for students that have come to the United States to complete their degrees and then to have this practical training time. Some of them during that work experience, either having lived in the United States for a number of years, may be more interested in perhaps a longer term stay in the United States that would allow them to continue to work. They may be working for companies that are very keen to keep them on board once they've had them employed for practical training time. Then there may be an interest in that company, but depending on the qualities that that student has brought and that graduate has brought to their businesses, may be looking to keep them longer. And companies that are willing to sponsor these students for an H-1B visa, they have opportunities to potentially stay another 3 to 6 years beyond their OPT time. So that H-1B experience is certainly something that Indian students have also historically been very, very much drawn to, particularly in the last 5 to 10 years. Typically, there are about 86,000 H-1B visas awarded each year. Some go to students who are on OPT that are continuing on into work in professional work in the United States in the computing fields or other STEM-related fields or other disciplines entirely. You also see H-1B applications going to individuals, employees who work at companies abroad that might be looking to set up U.S. operations or bring staff over from another subsidiary to work for another company in that country to head a department or to lead an initiative, new initiative in the United States. So H-1B is also used to bring employees direct from overseas, future employees direct from overseas, depending on their experiences in their home countries. India, again, and even more dramatically so than STEM OPT, you see 75.6% of H-1B petitions approved in fiscal 2017, almost 76% were born in India. Again, that's a combination of individuals that were born in India, came to the United, coming to the United States directly for this work permission through H-1B, or those that have come through primarily F-1 student status and then continued on through OPT and then maybe applying for H-1B with their employers. So there's a very distinct advantage, at least numerically, in terms of the Indian students that have come to the United States that are continuing on for STEM OPT, but also for, increasingly so, for those that are looking to stay longer with H-1B work permission. So with the employers that they end up signing on with. So as institutions that are looking to recruit in India, certainly the need for this demographic to have sustainable work opportunities and knowing what those prospects are is an important part of one of the major selling points that has been one of the major selling points of the U.S. higher education system for students from India, in addition to the quality of education here. But it's also increasingly the work opportunities that are important to them in their overall search. Certainly the students are, particularly those looking for graduate degrees, but certainly for undergraduates, you're going to have parents asking those questions. So Lou, thanks for joining me, and you probably have some experience working in India before on with tour providers as well as traveling there yourself. What that means, thanks for joining me on this one, about how important Indian students are to institutions and how the work opportunity piece is an important part of that conversation that universities need to have. So thanks for confirming that. What I would like to, another related topic, and this is the second major theme for today's chat that I would want to bring up with you is the impact of India in the global international student mobility market. For those of you who have been in recruiting for a while, you're certainly aware that they are a very significant part of not only the U.S. international student populations, but after China, are probably number two or three in half dozen other countries as a major source of students studying outside their home country. Certainly, Australia is a major, another major destination for Indian students, as is the UK, though less so over the past few years, but they seem to be about to rebound or in the process of rebounding. So what I see next is the article I'm bringing up next is actually an Indian piece, but it's from the perspective of how Australian universities are recruiting Indian students, how that may be changing as a primary focus. And the article is from Honi Sutt out of India, and it focuses on the universities turning to India after a projected decrease in China student money is expected. So Australia, as with most of the rest of the Western world, has invested heavily in recruiting in China over the last decade. And certainly what we're seeing now, there are reports that Australian universities have gotten through consulting work that they've done, that Chinese growth in Chinese students is, which has been going up, going on a clip at about 10 to 15% growth per year, is going to slow dramatically to maybe 5%. In the next few years. So what the report is prompting Australian institutions to potentially do is reassess where they're investing their recruitment dollars on the longer term. So what this article is making the case for, and from an Indian perspective, obviously there's a slight bent to it that that Indian students are going to be potentially the beneficiaries of this new attention that Australian universities are going to give. And it's not necessarily new attention, it's just increased attention. There was a time when Indian students, before China exploded onto the world stage in terms of as a source market for international students at all levels, undergraduate, graduate, and even high school, as we've seen in the U.S., You see, India was by far, because of proximity to Australia, cultural ties through the former Commonwealth, British Commonwealth, and existing Commonwealth ties. And there are, it was there was certainly an encouraging. This report is encouraging more Australian universities to change tack from because of the overwhelming. The predominance of Chinese students on Australian university campuses, which are now more than 40%, according to this report, 40% of all foreign students studying in Australia are Chinese. And at particular universities, the University of Sydney, University of New South Wales, more than 70% of international students on those two college campuses are Chinese. So there's very significant concerns, and I've said this for many years in terms of just ways you want to, as an international student office, recruitment office, working together as a campus, hopefully, as you plan international student recruitment, that you'd be very concerned with the amount of students you have from any one particular country, that you don't want it to any one demographic to predominate or to dominate your international student populations, where you have over 70% of your international cohort coming from one country. That can create some difficult synergies for institutions to deal with on a college campus, in terms of the impact that that large of a group will have on the rest of the international students as well as the population as a whole. So that's just something to think about. The article related to India obviously is that there have. They have been, their numbers have been growing again after a down period in the late '90s. And now India looks to again be an important, increasingly important source for universities in Australia. And there's lessons to be learned here, I think, because we, all of us in certainly the US that are paying attention to these trends as it relates to the next big source market. I don't think there's a big one that's going to emerge that isn't already out there, but certainly changes, significant changes in the fluctuations of flows of students from any one country, which probably will continue, and those will be there will be ups and flows. Saudi Arabia might be going has been going down the last couple of years, but they may be ticking back up in the next few years. We don't know, but there's signs that it might be happening, particularly on the ESL front. But you're also looking at India's forever has been a significant, almost exclusively a graduate market, but the undergraduate market has been continuing to build over the last 5 to 10 years, slowly, but it's growing, and that is a potential new market for a lot of institutions, and certainly one I think that a lot of U.S. schools at the undergraduate level are beginning to see opportunities to recruit in India and recruit directly from Indian high schools, but not just the international schools that a number of the tourists go to now, but direct to Indian national schools that are sending increasingly students abroad. So there are tour providers out there that are doing just that, going to the national schools. And I think for if you're not a big name school, there are a lot of opportunities that for you in India as well. I'm certainly one of the folks that I've gotten to know well over the past couple of years, 3 or 4 years actually, is Simple Ed, out of based in India, but they've their leadership has studied in the United States, and they are have a very good idea and have their fingers on the pulse of what's going on the ground. So that undergraduate market, I think, is in India is a real growth area for U.S. Institutions, even non-named, not big rank schools, have opportunities to really make an impact outside the tier one cities in India. And groups like Simple Ed are really well positioned to help organizations and institutions that are looking for that undergraduate market that maybe has been lacking from their overall recruitment efforts. So definitely one to keep an eye on as things progress. So, with regards to India and its appeal to U.S. institutions, to Australian institutions, as this article has pointed out, we're also want to end today with one story that covers a multitude of things, and that relates to institutions, U.S. institutions that decide to take stands, that ethical stances that may be put them at risk for a loss of market, or a loss of prestige, or loss of government contracts, perhaps, or other factors, local opinion, perhaps, that it might impact what they do if they take a stand. And this is a topic that I think in the article written by Michael Stoner, Real Leader, on enrollment management, marketing, and consulting services for domestic students, domestic institution, U.S. institutions for domestic recruitment. He makes the case in his article, Higher Ed Brands We Can Believe In, for what the implications are for U.S. institutions that take political stances or non-political stances, or the fact that they don't take a stance is often a stance. But what happens to them why they do what they do, and what taking a stand, as many institutions did when the first travel bans were announced from the Trump administration back in 2017, early 2017, after the inauguration, when those first started coming down, a number of presidents said, not on my campus. We're not going to, we want to project the image of we are a welcoming campus, a welcoming country. And certainly they made a very public statement with their repudiation of what the travel ban stood for. Just what they clearly stood for is a lot of things that are run counter to what academic freedom, higher education in the United States is all about. What the United States is all about being a welcoming country and environment for people from around the world. And that's certainly something that I think it's not just on this article on like the "You Are Welcome Here" or visa bans, that type of thing that Michael Stoner makes out in his article or in his opinion piece. But what he does make clear is that why institutions do that when they're driven by beliefs, their presidents and their boards take stances, whether it's against companies that, like, for example, what happened at the College of Ozarks in September, they announced they were cutting ties with Nike, which had been their athletic team's brand for a number of years, and they were cutting ties with Nike over the Colin Kaepernick ad. So that's certainly a very different way of approaching it from a higher ed perspective. So there's other ways that this raises its head, and certainly in terms of how a particular institution responds to world events, to local media, to national trends. A number of college campuses, also around the time the current president was elected, during the campaigns, there was talks of these massive deportations that would be going on to get rid of DACA students and Dreamers and that demographic. And those obviously have been deportations, but ones that have, at the time, you had college campuses saying, we are not going to be turning over data to the federal government should they come calling for who are your undocumented students on your college campus. So there's a lot out there that's, what it does do is it does certainly align institutions with causes that they believe in, and that becomes very public, and that appeals to certain demographics, and it doesn't appeal to others, and that certainly would can impact an institution's bottom line, and that's certainly something you're seeing on the international side, in addition to the travel bans that have popped up in the last couple of years, the different versions that have appeared. You also see some murmurings of that, and we touched upon this a little bit last week with what's happened in the wake of the murder of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul by Saudi nationals that were increasingly suspected to be directed by members of the royal family, or at least the Saudi government. So that final story is yet to be written there, but certainly the impact of that. You saw, and we alluded to it last week, you saw institutions that were beginning to review their agreements with institutions and ties with the Saudi Arabian government, with institutions within Saudi Arabia. And a colleague of mine, Liz Riceberg, at Boston College at their Center for International Education, has written a very thoughtful piece, I think, as far as looking at the impact of institutions who have Liz's work at the Center for International Higher Ed at Boston College. She's been an important piece there of that program at that center for a number of years as a research fellow. But she makes the point very clearly in her article that if institutions in the United States, as abhorrent as the Khashoggi murder and all the elements involved in what happened there, if institutions were to cut ties with any country who's that was responsible for these kind of human rights violations and murders and criminal acts, if an institution did that every time something like that happened, she points out, soon all international academic engagement would probably come to a screeching halt. And to be honest, there's a lot of truth to that because relationships between institutions are in different countries, are not necessarily representative of relationships between governments from different countries. You see what's happened with British universities, which hasn't happened in Britain between UK universities and Russian institutions. There's not been any cutting of ties there between institutions, even though it's very clearly and increasingly documented that the Russian government did have a very significant hand through the GRU in the murder, attempted murder of former Russian agents that had defected to the UK, Sergei Skripal and his daughter, that were poisoned. And that was a very much a government-led impact. It had certainly, the fallout from that had impacts at the highest level of governments, where diplomats were expelled from the UK and other countries in response to what that evidence was showing that it was a Russian government-initiated attack. Similarly, with in China, there's been for years there's been human rights abuses in China, but institutions have continually maintained ties or strengthened ties over those times too. But there's not just these large countries. You see other countries where human rights abuses have been perpetrated by governments on many different levels that hasn't impacted relationships between institutions, and frankly, should it? And Liz makes the very useful point that institutions to institution partnerships are often seen as kind of potential solutions or at least outlets for potential mediation, for potential agreements, a potential future softening of these government leadership's positions that have led to these human rights abuses to be committed in the first place. So I think, and I really applaud Liz for the stance she's taken in her article that, as abhorrent as these cases are, should it shouldn't that it shouldn't retreat it shouldn't force institutions to retreat from their academic collaborations across the distances of country borders often enforce. So I think that there's some real value in what she's saying there, and hopefully this is universities that don't take a stand by not cutting ties are ones that are not cutting themselves off from the rest of the world. So I think there's real value in for universities to be very circumspect and certainly making decisions at the highest level to end ties with a country, to end ties with the university. Are certainly ones that don't shouldn't get taken lightly, and oftentimes there are circumstances that the average person doesn't hear about. But the realities are that institutions that do take a stand, there are often consequences, both positive and negative. But one thing that's certain is that those institutions do get talked about. One thing I certainly encourage all my colleagues that are involved, particularly on the partnership side of international education, that as you develop these partnerships, go in with both eyes wide open, but also look at it as what we're all about in international education. That's building bridges, building mutual understanding between peoples of all countries. And what we do with our day-to-day jobs with students from around the world that come to our offices and we see recruiting out on the road, it also has the same impact at the upper levels of administration and beyond. The students that you are recruiting and having study on your campuses today become leaders in businesses, in the governments when they return. So how we treat them now, how we treat them with respect, and don't pigeonhole them in terms of identifying them with a government, or if you're a student from Brazil, you must all of a sudden believe that the new president Bolsonaro is your hero, and clearly that may not be the case. And for those in Brazil, I know we'll touch on this particular topic next week and what his election, Bolsonaro's election in Brazil, means for higher ed relations with the United States now. So there's a lot of, as always, there's a lot happening in international education, and certainly we'll be keeping you posted every week through this midweek roundup, and we appreciate you staying with us today. And also, whether you're catching up on YouTube or our Facebook page or listening on the podcast streams available for this midweek roundup, we appreciate you keeping us first in your thoughts, or at least in your thoughts for international education topics. And we look forward to future conversations down the road. So thanks for joining us today, and have a wonderful week.